From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The news flash this week from NASA's Kepler telescope data, Earth is not alone, or may not be. One in five stars in the Milky Way, our galaxy, have a planet the size of Earth at a distance that means the possibility of liquid water, i.e. potential Earths, Earth 2.0, maybe 40 billion of them. That's a lot to contemplate. This hour, On Point, we'll hear from the research team that brought the news and from more big thinkers on what's out there. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What if we are not alone? What if there are a lot of Earths, near Earths, potential Earths out there? How do you think about this news? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We go first right to the source today. Eric Pettigura is one of three researchers on the team that's been crunching data sent back by NASA's Kepler telescope. He's a doctoral candidate in astrophysics at the University of California, Berkeley, lead author with Andrew Howard of the University of Hawaii, and Jeffrey Marcy of UC Berkeley, of this study on Earth-like planets orbiting Sun-like stars. It's out in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Eric Pettigura in California, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
So we'll hear how you did it, what you looked for, but just go to your bottom line. Does this mean that there could be another Earth or a bunch of Earths out there, or you have no idea?
Absolutely. Our study showed that one in five Sun-like stars harbor an Earth-sized planet in the so-called habitable zone, which, as you mentioned earlier, is the range of orbits where liquid water is plausible on the planet's surface. So, you know, we measured a fraction, but if you multiply that fraction by the number of Sun-like stars in the galaxy, you get a number of 10 billion. And it seems with 10 billion rolls of the dice, the chance to get another planet similar to Earth seems almost certain.
Wait a minute. We thought it was 40 billion. Our hopes are collapsing. What's the how do those two numbers come out?
Yeah, exactly. So the number of stars in the galaxy actually isn't known exactly. So sometimes you hear 100 billion, sometimes you hear 400 billion, but a good reasonable number is 200 billion. So about a quarter of those stars are stars like the sun, stars that we included in our study.
What do you mean when you say like the sun, Eric?
Similar mass, similar temperature, similar size.
Okay.
So 50 billion sun-like stars. So one in five of those is about 10 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the vast majority of the stars in the galaxy are so-called red dwarfs, which are cooler, smaller than the sun. And if you add in the planets around those stars, then you get a number like 40 billion.
How did you find this percentage? What were you looking for? How did you use the Kepler telescope?
Sure. So Kepler is a really simple idea, and that's part of the reason why I like it so much. So Kepler is monitoring the brightness of 150,000 stars in the constellation Cygnus, which if you go outside at night and look up, is actually high overhead this time of year. And the Kepler field of view is about the size of your hand at arm's length, and we managed to look at 150,000 stars in that small region of the sky.
Okay.
So we monitored the brightness very precisely with the Kepler Space Telescope, looking for dimmings due to the chance crossing in front of the host star by a planet. And the period of those dimmings tells you something about how far the planet is from the host star, and the depth of those dimmings tells you something about the size.
Explain that. You say the period of the dimmings tells you how far it is and the depth. I mean, if it were very big, it could be confusing, couldn't it? Or
so the period, as you may know, so the Earth, of course, has a period of 365 Earth days.
Yeah.
The Earth goes around the sun.
So we've heard
365 days. Now, planets closer than the Earth orbit more rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
Mercury, for example, has a period of about 80 days. So by measuring the period of a planet's orbit, you know how far it is from its host star. And then think of just a planet crossing and casting a shadow over the face of the star.
Right.
The bigger the planet is, the bigger the shadow. And so by measuring how much the star dims, we know how big the planet is.
And you've been able to focus closely enough on all these stars for long enough that you actually tracked how often a particular shadow went across that very distant star?
Exactly. It's really amazing to think about it.
It is. Do you have a supercomputer? That must take just an enormous amount of tight focus.
Of course. We use supercomputers. That's something that you sort of can't get away from in the data-driven sciences today. So, yes, we used a supercomputer in Oakland, California to crunch all the data.
And out of that, you come up with 10 billion or 40 billion, many billion anyway, planets that look to you like they're about the size of Earth and they're about the distance that Earth is from our sun, they are from their star.
Yeah, so to be a little bit more specific, the number deals with planets between the size of Earth and twice the size of Earth,
Okay. And
planets that receive the same amount of energy from their host star as the Earth to within a factor of 4. So these planets are roughly the size of Earth and are bathed in the same amount of starlight as the Earth and should be about the same temperature as the Earth.
Amount of energy translates to heat or temperature.
Exactly.
So how do you think about that? That's a lot. That's a big number. 10 billion, 40 billion, either way. You know, what are the odds that somewhere out there, there are creatures, I don't know, mowing their lawns and going to bowling alleys? By which I mean planets so close to Earth in their characteristics that they might support life like ours. Is that a gigantic leap or out of 40 billion or 10 or not?
Well, let me sort of try to give a little more nuanced of an answer. So, you know, 10 billion, tens of billions, it's a large number. So if the parameters for life are fairly broad and life can form on a large percentage of those planets, then you should have billions of planets with life. If life is only a 1 in a million occurrence, then you still have tens of thousands of planets with life. But we don't actually know the exact combination of parameters that make a planet habitable. We think it might have something to do with the temperature of the planet, perhaps liquid water oceans, but we really don't know. So either life is extremely rare, sort of rare at the level of 1 in 10 billion, or the galaxy has other planets with life in it. It's those two interpretations.
And what's your presumption? Is your presumption that if the conditions for life are there, let's just say there was a planet exactly or, you know, really close to Earth out there. Is your presumption that if the conditions are there, life emerges, or you have no idea?
Well, that's the big question. So one thing that we know about the Earth is that life arose very soon after the Earth formed. Life has been on the Earth for the majority of the Earth's existence. So from that vantage point, it seems that it's very easy for life to get a toehold when the conditions are right. However, as I said before, the exact parameters, the exact nature of a planet that actually makes it habitable could be quite complicated, quite finely tuned. For example, the Earth has a large moon, which is thought to stabilize the orbit of the Earth. Maybe that's important. For example, Jupiter, being sort of the big kid in town, sweeps out comets and asteroids and helps prevent giant impacts like the ones that killed the dinosaurs from occurring more often. So there really could be a whole ton of parameters that are important.
How do you think about this now? Do you go around thinking, well, yeah, maybe there are a bunch of Earth 2.0s, or we found some interesting data but still have no idea?
So it's really changed my personal perception. I've been working a lot of late nights recently and walking home at night. And I sort of look up at those twinkling lights a little differently these days. You know, I sort of count them by fives. One of the really, I think, profound implications of this work is not just the sheer number of planets, the 10 billion, tens of billions, but the fact that because they're so prevalent, the distance to the nearest one should be fairly close. It should be in our astronomical backyard. So with the fraction of Earth-sized planets in the habitable zone that we calculated, the expected distance to the nearest one should be about 12 light years, which is among the nearest sun-like stars.
But in human terms of consequence, 12 light years is still just ginormous. I mean, the odds of us ever having any contact with that aren't they just minute? Anything 12 light years away?
So with current technology, yes. The fastest spacecraft will take millions of years to reach a distance of 12 light years from the Earth. But, of course, our radio signals travel at the speed of light. We could imagine communicating with sort of a similar civilization on a planet 12 light years away, sort of with a 12-year delay time between send and receive. And I think it's entirely possible in the not-too-distant future that we could actually travel to these planets or at least send our probes or offspring to these planets.
We're going to hear in a moment from a couple of your fellow space scientists and get their reaction and thoughts on this. But what kind of reaction are you getting from the field? Are people like, holy smokes, or rolling their eyes when you talk about, 12 years request for a, I don't know, how do you fix your turkeys on a little planet out there somewhere? Do you brine or do you bake?
The response from the community has been absolutely just humbling and very, very warm. And I've been having a great last couple of days.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the potential for other planets like Earth out there, Earth 2.0, and billions of possibilities just revealed. There was a time when there was a lot we didn't know, but we speculated. Here's Carl Sagan, the famous Billions and Billions. Carl Sagan reading from his 1994 book, Pale Blue Dot, writing about and discussing the possibility of other habitable planets.
Here and there, peppered across space, orbiting other suns. Maybe there are worlds something like our own, on which other beings gaze up and wonder as we do about who else lives in the dark.
Ah, he had a way of putting it. And here's the launch of the space telescope Kepler from Cape Canaveral, March 2009. The telescope that has given us the data that everybody's talking about this week. Here goes Kepler up into space.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. Engine start, 1, 0, and liftoff of the Delta II rocket with Kepler on a search for planets in some way like our own.
The news this week? Well, they may just have found some really interesting material out there. Maybe 2.0. Eric Pettigura is with us. He is lead author of the study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the journal, that says, hey, there may be 10 billion, there may be 40 billion Earth-like planets out there. He's at the University of California, Berkeley, doctoral candidate there in astrophysics, joining us today from Mountain View, California. Eric, I want to bring in a couple of others from the field with me in the studio. Sarah Seeger, astrophysicist, professor of planetary science and physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. She was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant this year for her work on exoplanets, that is, planets outside of our solar system. Among her work are two projects, the Exoplanet Sat, a nanosatellite searching for Earth-like planets, and the NASA Explorer mission TESS, a space telescope designed to search for exoplanets, due to be launched in 2017. Sarah Seeger, wonderful to have you back. Welcome.
Great to be here, Tom.
Great to have you. And with us in the studio, David Kipping, exoplanetologist, exomoonologist, and astronomer, Carl Sagan Fellow at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, where he researches extrasolar planets and moons, principal investigator of the Hunt for Exomoons with the Kepler Project. David Kipping, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me.
All right. So now we've got three scientists at the virtual table. Sarah, you've heard Eric begin to lay out their research and what they're up to. As you listen, as you read, what are the questions that come to your very well-informed mind on this front?
Sure. Well, I'd just like to start by saying you would not believe how many hundreds of hours, tens or hundreds of hours, that astronomers spent wondering how common are other Earths. This was a decade or more ago. We would meet five times a year to discuss a direct imaging space mission. We called it Terrestrial Planet Finder. Mm-hmm. we really argued forever, and we said, you know, Kepler's going to have to tell us the answer. So, Eric, here's the thing.
Is this it? Is this the answer?
Well, that's the question. Is this the answer? Because you're saying 1 in 5 here, but there are big error bars. There's been some so-called modest extrapolation. I just want you to know, for direct imaging, it really, really matters what that number is, if it's 1 in 5, 1 in 3, 1 in 10. So perhaps you could give us more of a feel for that.
And just before we get that, just about 1 in 5, i.e., 1 in 5,
1 in 5 stars may have an Earth-like planet in an Earth-like orbit about a sun-like star.
And the question you're putting to Eric for we mere mortals is?
Well, the question is it... there are big uncertainties on this number, and I'd like him to just explain what those uncertainties mean. And, you know, I think we
sort
all...
Sort of margin of error question.
Margin of error, right, and it's quite large. It was given to us as 22 plus or minus 8%.
Eric, how about it? What's your margin of error, your degree of certainty here?
Sure, yeah. So I think Sarah raises an interesting point. You know, the first time you ever, you know, make a measurement, you know, your uncertainties are quite large. But if you think about what the uncertainties were before, you know, ranging from, you know, 1 in a million to 100%, we're certainly doing a lot better now.
That's not the question. You know, we're considering spending $1 billion. There's some committee work going on, concept studies, and that number really matters now. And I don't think it's the first answer, but it might also be the last answer here. So that's why the uncertainties are so important. You know,
why is this important in terms of future planned exploration or observation of space, Sarah, this degree of certainty and the ratio of likely stars likely capable of supporting Earth-like planets?
Well, here's the thing. In Eric and others' studies, and all the studies we're all doing, we can't tell the difference between an Earth and a Venus. Earth and Venus are about the same size. They're about the same mass. They fit within that factor of four difference in energy coming from the sun that they're including. But as you know, Venus has a surface hot enough to melt lead, and Earth is habitable. So we need to do a totally different type of space mission to look at the atmosphere to see if that planet is habitable or indeed inhabited. And that's a very complicated and expensive mission. So we want to not hedge our bets. We want to know what the numbers are. We need a huge mission if Earths are rare. We need a much smaller, more affordable, doable mission if they're not rare. So that's why we want to know the uncertainty.
There's a couple things, and David, I want to come to you, but there's a couple things in that really catch my mind. First, you're suggesting that these future plans for space observation, exploration going on now in the United States are largely hinged to a search for Earth-like planets? It's not just exploration writ large?
I won't say they're hinged, but the search for an Earth is so compelling and so overwhelming, it's probably the only thing that's going to get our space telescope launched. And I just want you to know, I woke up at 4 in the morning this morning, and I was working on this, we're working on a mission study to actually go and do this.
Yeah.
And it's for whatever we've been tasked by NASA to come back and say, what can we do for $1 billion? And I'll tell you what, for $1 billion, we can find a bunch of Earths if it's 1 in 5. But if it's a lot worse than that, well, we may not actually have the motivation to get this launched.
This makes a big material difference then. Eric, can you tell the difference in your data between Earth and Venus?
So I think Sarah raises an interesting point. And of course, she's well aware of this, I know. So Earth, Venus, and Mars are all within the habitable zone, the zone where liquid water could plausibly exist on the surface. Now, as we know now, Venus doesn't have liquid water on the surface. Mars certainly doesn't. But there's ample evidence that Mars at one time had liquid water on the surface, and there's less compelling evidence, but there's still evidence that Venus could have had liquid water on the surface. So what all that Kepler is telling us is sizes and energy incident on the surface of the planet. That's all we know.
But this narrows our understanding of what you're telling us quite dramatically, because when we say Earth-like, most of us don't think of Venus, where, you know, you don't want to set foot. And we've seen Mars up close, and it doesn't look like a place for a holiday.
Well, I don't think we're arguing that. We're in agreement that any planet could be habitable. They're all different. They all have different atmospheres with different greenhouse effects. We just wanted Eric to help the public understand.
You're saying Venus is habitable?
Not now, but I'm just saying that we could have a type of planet in a Venus-like orbit that could be habitable if it had much less carbon dioxide or if it was different. I think the point we're trying to get Eric to address here for the public is how does that margin of error translate into what we can think when we look up at the sky?
Well, that's the big question, right? Just because a planet is in the habitable zone doesn't mean that it's habitable or it doesn't mean that it's inhabited. So, you know, how likely is it for a given planet in the habitable zone to turn into a Venus or Mars? We just don't know. So we should consider that uncertainty when we launch future missions to actually image these planets and study their atmospheres.
I want to come back to this as it pertains to what we may actually do, what NASA may actually do. David Kipping, as you're listening to all this, first of all, how do you take these findings on board? What strikes you as most significant about them, and what questions do they raise for you?
Well, first of all, I think this is an incredibly important paper for the field. This is a question that not just, as Sarah said, that astronomers have been wondering for the last decade or two. It's actually a question that even in ancient Greece, philosophers were wondering whether there are other worlds like our own. So It's an incredibly important paper. And I think we're a very lucky generation to be that generation which gets to take the first peek behind the curtain. And I think that's an important point as well. This is a starting point for trying to work out how many true Earth analogues there are. We now know from Eric's very important study that around one in five Sun-like stars have Earth-sized planets about the same distance from the Sun that the Earth is. But that doesn't mean, as Sarah has said and Eric has said, that they are truly going to be habitable. There are many things we don't know. So I really think this is an important paper, but it's certainly not the end of the road. We have a lot more work to do to understand what fraction of these are habitable. I mean, one thing I'd like to ask Eric is, out of these planets, I mean, one thing we know is that if the orbit is elliptical, so the Earth goes around on a very circular orbit around the Sun, which means that its distance from the Sun and the amount of heat it receives from the Sun is more or less the same all year round. Now, if the orbit is elliptical, and the reason why that's important is because many of the planets we've discovered out there happen to have highly elliptical orbits.
They will fry and freeze.
Exactly. Sometimes they come very close to the star and they get baked in heat, and sometimes they become frozen 6 months later as they drift out. So, Eric, I'm interested, what fraction of these long-period Earth-sized planets do you think would have elliptical orbits that might be a problem for habitability?
Eric?
So we really just don't know. So what David's talking about is sort of, you know, how circular or elliptical the orbits are.
Yeah, I think we get it.
We know from our studies of Jupiter size and Saturn size objects that many of those, in fact, have so-called eccentric or elliptical orbits. But we really don't know that quantity for these small planets. Our resolution, our sensitivity is just not good enough to measure that parameter. So for all we know, these planets could be circular or they could be elliptical. Now, I'll just mention that one thing Kepler is finding, and this has truly been a surprise, are these compact multi-planet systems where you have six or seven planets all in a very tight plane, in the host around the host star. And these planets probably are in circular orbits, because if they were in elliptical orbits, their orbits would cross, they would destabilize each other, they would, the systems would fall apart. So we at least have sort of indirect evidence that these small planets certainly can be in circular orbits.
That's true, but do you think the systems that the fraction you've derived is true for multi-planet systems as it is for single-planet systems? And maybe in those single cases, there's no reason necessarily to believe that they could be on those.
You know, it's possible that of the three of us, you're the best one to answer that question.
What do you think, David?
Well, I mean, I would have to say that recent work has shown, as Eric has pointed out, that for Jupiters at these sort of periods in single systems, the eccentricity is a very, it can be very high. These orbits can be very elliptical. Now, we don't know if that's true for the smaller planets, like the Earth. But if we take an extrapolation and say that they behave the same, then it's maybe a worrisome thing.
But that could take a significant margin of these away. There are a lot of pieces in play here. We're going to look deeper. We've got lots of listeners calling in to join us. Let's go to Jeff in Belchertown, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Dom.
Hi.
So I just want to say thank you to everybody for doing the research in the first place, because from my perspective as just one human on Earth, the answer seems to be no duh that there's going to be life everywhere else. I also want to say, in regards to like travel and things like research, you know, Lockheed Martin just announced that they're going to be making an airplane that goes Mach 6. So I understand that there's different physics between traveling on Earth and in space, but it's just really to point out that how important the research is, because we're never going to get anywhere if we don't actually spend time thinking about it. So that's what I have to say, and thank you so much for all the smart scientists everywhere in the world.
Yes, amen to that. Sarah, what about Jeff says, look, he just looks up at the sky and says, no duh, of course there are Earth-like planets and life out there. But is that your presumption?
Well, here's the thing. As scientists, we just hesitate to speculate, especially not on national radio. And so we seen as believing for us. So yes, of course we look up at the sky also, and we wonder if anyone's looking back at us. But before we can say anything for sure, we like to have numbers. And that's what we finally have.
This comes closer. Jeremy in Northampton, Massachusetts. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
What's your question?
My question is, why is it always presumed that liquid water is essential for life on another planet? Obviously, if it's a planet that humans want to live on, then that's important. But isn't it possible that life could spring up on another planet without the existence of liquid water in extreme temperatures?
Well, here's the thing, is that now people are thinking you're correct, that we just need some kind of liquid where molecules can break apart and
reform.
Not necessarily liquid water.
What?
Well, it could be like we could imagine liquid methane and ethane, like what's on Titan. Titan is a moon of Saturn that has very cold lakes. However, here's the thing, that water is still the most abundant liquid that we can think about in terms of planetary material. And in terms of planets that we can actually observe any time in our lifetime, it's only those with the temperatures of liquid water. It's not very cold objects like Titan. So no matter how we slice and dice this, we're pretty much stuck with liquid water, although it's not a requirement for all life as far as we understand.
If there were a life form based on liquid methane or ethane, would we see it? Would we recognize it?
Would we comprehend it? You see, for astronomers, we're not so fixated on comprehending what the life is. We just think about what life does. Life metabolizes and releases gases into the atmosphere, some of which can accumulate and be detected remotely. So we're not, if there is life, we think we can find out whether some types of life exist just based on looking at the atmosphere for signs of gases that are there or not there. We can't really address that question you're asking yet.
Okay, one more. Eric in Nashville, Tennessee. Eric, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. I'm sort of perplexed at something here, and I'm glad you got the scientists on. And earlier, the first scientist, Eric, I think his name is.
Yes.
You know, they're talking about life forming, and as scientists, I'm curious as to have any of them as scientists ever done a calculation of the odds of life forming. In other words, if we have all you know, these planets, these elements, which are obviously inorganic, non-living, what are the odds or possibility of life generating from non-life? We've never observed it in this perfect environment that we have here on Earth. Even though we're human beings with brains and we're trying our darndest.
Well, but of course, we are the very evidence of life having emerged. I mean, here we are on this planet. So I guess in one sense, we are the answer to the question here, aren't we?
No, it's an assumption there. My question is, why is it that there's the assumption that life formed from non-life, and what are the possibilities or the odds that, because there are obviously two options as to how life came
about. Eric,
we
got our time is short before the break. I'd say we're exhibit A. Am I missing something, David?
No, I think, you know, with abiogenesis is what we call it as scientists, the start of life. It is kind of difficult to work out exactly under what conditions it started on the Earth, since no one was around to observe it. But the problem is that even if abiogenesis is going on all the time, life starts every day, right in this room right now. The problem is that this planet is completely saturated with bacteria, microbial life, which is all related to us as well. And that life just completely would outcompete any emerging life.
So, and the odds on another planet? I mean, Eric says, look, it happened here very early, apparently. What does that say about the odds of life somewhere else generating out of the inorganic?
Yeah, I mean, it's tempting to look at that fact and say, well, that's a very good thing. But honestly, it depends about how special the Earth is.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the potential for other planets like Earth out there. Earth 2.0 and billions of possibilities just revealed in research that's been brought to us by, among others, our guest today, Eric Pettigura, lead author on this new paper coming out, saying the Hubble telescope shows us there may be 10 billion potential Earth-like planets out there, maybe more, maybe 40 billion. He joins us today from Mountain View, California. He's a doctoral candidate in astrophysics at the University of California, Berkeley. David Kipping is with us as well, exomoonologist, exoplanetologist, astronomer. Sarah Seeger is here, astrophysicist, planetary scientist, MacArthur Genius Grant winner. We're going to talk a little bit later in this segment about India's Mars shot that just went up, what was it, yesterday? We'll look at that in just a moment. Lots of questions, lots of callers. Steve in Brookline, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Steve.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
We've been sweeping the skies for a long time looking for radio signals coming from out there, and it seems somehow ironic that with this proliferation of potential Earths that we haven't heard anything. Why not?
Okay. Sarah, how about it? If they're out there, why haven't we heard?
If you talk to the people who run these searches, they will tell you that their search space so far is the equivalent to having searched one glass of water compared to the Earth's entire oceans.
So they with these Kepler findings?
Aside from the Kepler findings. Okay. So the thing is that it's hard to search. There's a huge amount of space out there. But I can assure you that right now, SETI is searching on those Kepler targets.
Matthew in Amherst, New York. Matthew, you're on. SETI, I should say. That's the one listening for Are You Out There Live. Matthew, you're on.
Hi. I had a question about whether or not the density of these planetary materials that we're discovering would affect the ability for the planets to develop life.
Eric, how about it? The density. Are you able to measure that from your findings, and does it matter?
So, yeah. So the caller touched on a really important point, which is, and I've said this before, is that all Kepler measures is the size of the planet. So we have no idea what the masses of these planets are, and hence the densities. So some of these planets could have thick hydrogen and helium atmospheres or other gases which might affect the planet's ability to start life. So that's why future missions to actually measure the masses, measure the densities are important. All we've measured are the sizes.
So indeed, it could matter. Daryl in Nashville, you're on the air, Daryl.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'll make a quick point. I think that there is most definitely life out there, whether they're in the Neanderthal phase or more advanced than we are, trying to seek other planets. But my main question is, shouldn't we be finding these planets and researching to be able to get there? Because in many years, 100 years, 200 years, is our Earth going to be habitable? What we're doing to the planet? Is a meteor going to come to us? Are we going to have to find another place to live so our civilization can survive?
Daryl, you've got it. You put what I think is in the back of a lot of people's minds, even if we may be on different, very different timescales. I mean, is there a bailout strategy in any of this, David Kipping? People may think of it. Daryl's thinking of it. But is that realistic in any way?
We know that the dinosaurs were wiped out 65 million years ago by a giant asteroid hitting the Earth. So it's just really a matter of time until the same thing ultimately happens to the Earth here as well.
Even if we don't do it to ourselves.
Yeah, even if we don't do it to ourselves, which is a big if as well.
So is there a bailout strategy where we flee to another hospitable planet?
I think that's a big impetus. That's one of the reasons why people talk about colonizing Mars and the Moon, let alone Earth twins, which may be many light years away. And right now, there just really isn't serious funding to try and broach that. I mean, NASA is funded about 0.5% of the total budget. If you doubled that, then we could start talking seriously about colonizing Mars or building bases there in the near future. But it's not really a serious proposition right now.
Eric Pettigura, you've been right on this research. We only have you for a minute more. What about that question? Do you think about it? Do you see a bailout strategy somewhere in the data that's come back from Kepler, or does that sound fanciful to you?
Well, my own personal opinion is, I think we should work on resolving our differences here on Earth and making the Earth a more pleasant place. But yes, in the long-term future, I think it's entirely reasonable to think about colonizing the Moon, colonizing Mars, terraforming, so to speak. And then in the more distant future, because these planets around other stars are so far away. Yes, thinking about sending probes, thinking about sending our offspring there.
You're blowing our minds. You have all week with this news. Eric Pettigura, along with Andrew Howard and Jeffrey Marcy, author of the new study, Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences, Prevalence of Earth-Sized Planets Orbiting Sun-like Stars out of Kepler. Eric, thank you very much for being with us. Wonderful to have you today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
One more right here. Copley, Ohio. Hakeem is calling. Hakeem, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, in terms of the philosophic implications of life on distant planets, it would alter our philosophy on religion and philosophy. For instance, we think that we're so special as humans and that we're created in God's image and all this stuff. But if there are life forms on other planets, and the God of all creation is the God for all of us, we'd have to really look seriously at our philosophies and religious ideologies. And I think it would evolve that somewhat. And I think that's a fascinating thought.
I'm right there with you, Hakeem. You're thinking large. I mean, Sarah, is this a prompt to us to
reconsider some philosophic implications, our Earth-centric view of the cosmos, our anthro-human-centric view.
I think Hakim just asked one of the best questions we've ever been asked. And I want you to know that people are thinking about this from a few years ago, workshop at the Vatican, to even today when people show up from all over the world and want to talk to us about exoplanets and what it means. However, we're not quite there yet. It's going to be a while before we identify signs of life robustly in other worlds. But meanwhile, the world is waiting, and I think Hakim has hit on a huge thing, that our whole planet is going to undergo some kind of, you know, mind-boggling revolution in religion and society when the time comes.
David Kipping, what do you think are the odds that we'll ever really know? Here we are, we're getting more information, we're thinking about the odds, but as you say, the dinosaurs got wiped out. You know, there could be a big boy asteroid out there for us as well with our name on it, or maybe we do it to ourselves. I mean, there's intersecting timelines that may never intersect here. We may speculate and never know.
This is, in fact, one of the big questions about perhaps why we haven't found other civilizations, is that perhaps civilizations only live for a few hundred years, maybe a few thousand years, before they basically, for whatever reason,
like
disappear.
Like fireflies, lightning bugs.
Exactly. And that may be one of the solutions as to why we haven't heard from ET yet. But I think even when we know the answer, although some of us will be able to change our mindset about our place in the universe, mm-hmm. I want to caution that throughout history, whenever science has come forward and say, hey, you know, the Earth isn't the center of the universe, the Sun is the center of the universe, as Copernicus did, religion is able to adapt, and it's able to change its worldview to accommodate these new findings in science. So I wouldn't be totally surprised if people's world beliefs can more or less remain unchanged and accommodate these new discoveries.
Well, we heard Hakim right there in his quick call from, was it Ohio, putting a monotheistic, you know, one God overall framework around it, even as we expand what we understand being potentially within that frame. Wow. Big deal, Sarah? Big enough to get your next NASA project off the ground here?
Well, here's the thing. We call this the completion of, when the time comes, the completion of the Copernican Revolution. Hundreds of years ago, people thought that everything revolved around Earth, the Sun and all the other planets. Copernicus showed us, only to be validated we probably don't have time to get into
but
Copernicus showed us that actually everything goes around the Sun. Then later on, we learned that our Sun is but one of many, many stars in our Milky Way galaxy. And now we know that our Milky Way galaxy is only one out of over 100 billion galaxies. So yes, we're about to put the final nail in the coffin of our terracentricity.
And this potential, 40 billion potential Earths, just in the Milky Way galaxy, multiply it by all the others, we're into big numbers and a mind-expanding time and level of insight here. Wonderful to have the two of you with us. Sarah Seeger at MIT, thank you so much for coming in today, Sarah.
It's been great to be here.
And David Kipping from Harvard, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
In a moment, we will look at India's just-launched space shot to Mars. This is On Point. Yesterday, India launched a rocket into space on a mission to orbit Mars. The implications are big for India and more. A successful mission by India, by its Mars orbiter, would make that country the first Asian nation to reach the red planet. And they are attempting it on a budget just a little more than a tenth of what NASA's latest Mars orbiter cost. Let's listen to the sound. Yesterday morning, 9:08 UTC, not our time zone, a polar satellite launch vehicle carrying India's first mission to orbit Mars cleared the tower at the Satish Dhawan Space Center in Sriharikota, Andhra Pradesh, India.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, +1, 2, 3.
Liftoff.
Liftoff normal.
There is the new sound of takeoff from Earth. With us now from New York with the details, Tariq Malik, managing editor for Space.com, where he's been following India's first Mars mission. Tariq Malik, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here. What are they up to?
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here. Well, the big eyes on this Indian mission right now is on tonight. Tonight, this spacecraft in orbit around Earth is going to fire its engines for the first time in one of several maneuvers to start its journey to Mars. It has to go right. It has to go right many times throughout the rest of the month before it actually begins the final leg to Mars.
Has anyone other than the United States at this point ever sent up a vehicle that orbited Mars?
Well, there's several orbiters around Mars right now. One of them is from Europe, the European Space Agency's Mars Express spacecraft. It's been very successful, about 10 years now. But several Asian nations have tried. Japan and China, most recently, both have failed to get there. It's just a hard place to get to.
Did they try in the same way that India did, up into Earth orbit and then on from there?
No, they actually launched in different ways. Japan has a rocket that was able to launch its orbiter Nozomi in 2003 on a relatively direct way. It launched out towards Mars and then began a long trajectory. It had a lot of health problems on the way, which led to its failure when it arrived. Now, China went a different route, piggybacked on a Russian mission to actually explore Mars's moons. Now, that kind of came back and bit them when that mission failed to leave Earth orbit to, you know, begin its journey too. So
can you describe technically how India's physically, how this is working? What have they put up into Earth orbit, and what exactly will happen tomorrow, as you say, when the next phase is triggered?
Well, what India has built is a car-sized spacecraft that borrows a lot from the success the country has had with its moon probes. It's got a lot of the same types of technology, some new instruments that are built specifically for Mars exploration. And they built it on a budget, something like almost $74 million compared to NASA's $671 million on its probe launching later this month. So it's really kind of a compact probe that they've built. Now, it has to loop around Earth about, you know, six or seven times before it can get the speed it needs to really slingshot out towards Mars. And that's what's going to happen tonight. The first of those engine maneuvers to change its orbit build up more speed in order to reach Mars.
Has the United States used this slingshot-style launch or something different?
Well, the United States has used larger rockets to either launch straight out, or maybe there's one or two orbits around Earth to build that speed up. Nothing as extensive as this. What India is trying to do is reach Mars on the least amount of fuel possible, which requires this many slingshot trips around the Earth. What NASA has done for other probes has been to whip around other planets, Mercury, Venus, you know, those types of flybys. Mm-hmm. Last month we saw the Juno probe to Jupiter whip back around Earth on a return trip. So it's been done in the past, not to the extent for a single mission to Mars in this regard.
Now, a $74 million launch compared to the U.S. billion plus, that sounds like more than just a cheap labor play, you know. How are they doing this so economically?
Well, what they've been doing is first they used a smaller rocket, this Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle. It's not it's not India's biggest rocket, but it is dependable. They know how it works. So that kind of keeps the price relatively low on the launch vehicle side. Then they borrowed as much technology as they could from their moon probe, the Chandrayaan-1 probe, and then added some tailored bits, instruments for Mars, methane search, those types of things to kind of keep everything on a budget. At the same time, they're using existing capabilities. NASA's Deep Space Network will help India track this spacecraft on its way to Mars, to really leverage what they can do in order to make this first interplanetary mission a success for them.
How many moon probes has India put up?
Well, India has done one now, the Chandrayaan-1, and they're developing a sequel to that, Chandrayaan-2. Now, this first mission was a big coup for India, because before it went offline in 2009, it really was one of the spacecraft that confirmed the existence of water on the moon. That was a big win. For India's space program, a lot of cachet there. They're hoping that this Mars probe will build on that in its search for methane, too, another long mystery on Mars.
I used to live in Andhra Pradesh, the part of India this was launched from. When I was there, the idea of India launching a Mars probe was incomprehensible. Now, here they are. I mean, their pace of progress is amazing. Do we have a competitor here? Do we have a partner here in space exploration?
I think it could be construed as both. You know, India has been making stepping stone advances in space technology throughout the last few decades. They launched communication satellites. Much of that technology also incorporated into this Mars probe. They launched this moon spacecraft that was amazing. It dropped probes on the moon. It had a little Indian flag that was on those probes when they landed on the moon. And they're also targeting, they're developing a capsule to launch people into space, too. That's further down the road. So there is a potential there for a partner, or in Asia particularly, a competitor, because as you mentioned earlier, they would be the first Asian nation to reach Mars if this is a success next year.
Just amazing news out of India. We'll watch closely and look at the next phase when they slingshot toward Mars. Tariq Malik at space.com, you're terrific in laying it out for us, and we thank you very much for joining us today. Thanks for being on.
A pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Watch that night sky and more. Wow, just incredible. Tomorrow in this hour, we'll talk about rollout woes and beyond. We'll have a defender and a critic of Obamacare debating the Affordable Care Act's coming impact on this country and the rollout right now. Join us for that. Thanks for being with us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.